I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. We're learning more about the human brain through imaging technology. One of the side effects is a greater understanding of the role it plays in human health. The emerging field of integrative medicine takes a whole person approach to health, including your physical and emotional well-being, your social connections, your spiritual life, your diet and level of activity. And it turns out your brain plays an essential role in mobilizing healing and prevention. Our guests, physicians Andrew Newberg and Daniel Monti, are respectively the research director and CEO of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Thomas Jefferson University. They've got a new book. It's called Brain Weaver, and it's about how to optimize a healthy brain based on some of the latest in neuroscience research. Let me introduce our two guests. Daniel Monti, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's always a pleasure, Marty.
And Andrew Newberg is here in our Philadelphia studios. And Andrew, it's been a couple of years. Nice to have you back with us as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. So let me begin with a basic question. And Daniel Monti, I'll put this to you. It's kind of where your book starts. What do you mean by optimal brain health? And take us, I guess, sort of inside the brain and sort of outside about sort of how we navigate in the world. What is the answer to that?
It's a complex question, but the answer is both complex and there's also some simple tools. And that's really what our book is about. That's why we decided to write it, because as we understand, as you mentioned in the introduction, the neurophysiology and neurobiology of the brain, we are immediately impressed by how the brain doesn't just sit in the head in isolation. That we're an integrated system of networks and everything's in communication with everything else. And so we now know that the foods that we eat can affect the way that the brain functions. We now know that inflammation in the system can have a direct impact on inflammation in the brain. We now know that some of the risk factors that we're concerned about for many of the illnesses that affect many people in the body or brain have this common mechanism of inflammation, and that there's a lot we can do about it. The great thing is that Dr. Newberg, my partner in looking at all of these things, is one of the world's, he's too humble to say it, so I'll say it, is one of the world's renowned experts in brain imaging. And some of the work that we've done really captures how the brain functions differently when we do different things.
Well, let me pick up on several things there. And actually, I'll go to you, Andrew Newberg. And one of the features of the brain, as I think Daniel Monti was referencing, is its neuroplasticity. It's just not sitting there in stasis. It's
constantly changing.
It's constantly changing.
Right, exactly. And how we allow it to change and how we can help it to change in positive ways is exactly what we're talking about in Brain Weaver. And to just pick one very specific example, we've done a study of people who are under a lot of stress, usually patients who have cancer, for example, and have a lot of traumatic memories related to that. And it kind of sets your brain up in this very negative way. You're kind of fearful about every little pain, every little thing that's going on. And we had them do a very special kind of mind-body practice called the neuro-emotional technique, which maybe we can even expand upon a little later. But when people go through that program and it kind of rewires, which is essentially what you're talking about when you're talking about neuroplasticity, it changes the way the brain reacts to all of these different stressors. And then we do the brain imaging. We actually play an audio file when people are listening to those stressors, you know, remembering when they were in the room with the doctor and they heard that they had metastatic cancer or, you know, was worse than they thought. And suddenly, because they've gone through a program that helps to rewire the brain in a positive way, their brain doesn't react in that same kind of way.
You can see that, right?
You can see it. Yeah, the emotional centers of the brain treat it like every other kind of memory instead of treating it like something that's very traumatic to it. So we can absolutely change the brain. And the really good news is that we can change the brain basically until you die. I mean, people who are in their 80s and 90s and hundreds, you know, we've done some studies looking at mindfulness practices and it changes their brains too. So, you know, it doesn't have to be just for the young.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Daniel Monti, I'll go back to you. Then help us, though, understand how aging affects the brain. The brain of, let's say, a 25-year-old versus the brain of a 75-year-old. What are the distinguishing features?
There are some age-related changes that occur. And of course, as we live in the world and get exposed to toxins or increased inflammation from things we can control, things that we can't control, that all can have its effect. But that's only part of the story. And it used to be sort of a bleak story. It used to be that, well, you know, the age will, the brain will decline with age, and that's just the way that it is, and it doesn't change. You can't actually create dynamic improvements in the brain because that just doesn't exist. That's what thinking was for a very long time. And it's really only in the recent advances of neuroscience do we understand that when you age, the brain can actually improve in many ways, as Dr. Newberg was saying, and that there can be new learning, there can be new connectivity. Some of the things that we're talking about, people say that their brain functions better than it has for 20 years. So the idea that, well, you know, I'm aging, so my brain is just going to decline too, is not necessarily the case. And in fact, that's the opposite is really the good news that we want to talk about, so that people feel empowered to do some of the things that we've seen can make a huge difference.
Well, let me go back to you, Andrew Newberg, then. And I guess the thing that comes to mind are crossword puzzles, you know, things that we think of as stimulating the brain. Take us into what would help to keep a aging brain healthy.
Sure. Well, and let me pick up also on what Dr. Monti was just saying, which is that when we talk about optimal brain health, especially as we age, part of what we're talking about is balance. And, you know, there are many different processes that are going on in the brain, and how they are balanced is very important. So part of what we're talking about in Brainweaver is getting each person in touch with who they are. We all have strengths and weaknesses, and some people are better at remembering names, and some people are worse at remembering names. And so we can use the different, and some are better with our diet, and some are worse. So we try to help people with trying to find that right balance. And you mentioned things like doing different games and so forth. Well, everything that you do with the brain can be beneficial, but you do want to think about it from a balance perspective. So if all you ever do is crossword puzzles, well, your brain will get very good at doing crossword puzzles, but it may not necessarily help you to, you know, remember where your keys were.
They're in the refrigerator, just so you know.
They're probably next to the crossword puzzle. Exactly. But part of what we talk about is that, you know, there are really four different dimensions of the person. There's our biological, which is, you know, all of the, you know, all the chemicals and the neurotransmitters that are in the brain, and we want to optimize that. There's our psychological state, how we kind of look at our world. There is the social interactions, which of course have been, you know, very drastically affected by the pandemic, but nonetheless, we can, you know, our brain is designed to be social. And so we want to engage with people, we want to engage with friends. And then there's even the spiritual, which is the creative and maybe even the religious aspect. So if you can, you know, do crossword puzzles because you like them, that's great. But you want to take a walk in the woods, you want to listen to NPR and learn something about the world, you want to talk to a friend about, you know, the political state of the world, you want to go out and exercise, you want to do all of these different things because that's the best way of balancing your brain.
Well, that sounds, Daniel Monti, like cross training, right?
A little bit. The thing that we are really excited about is that these different dimensions of the brain that Dr. Newberg is talking about, we've studied them. We wanted to share this information because we've been doing this. Him and I have been working together for 12 years now on these different dimensions of the brain and looking through different clinical trials at what the brain does, how it functions, how it talks to itself, those pathways in the brain where the different parts of the brain communicate with itself can change so markedly when we address these four dimensions of life. So I think the important take home is, and kind of just picking up on what Andrew is saying, is that while some people might really have it down doing some of the cognitive exercises and keeping their brain sharp that way, they may not be so great at moving their body around. And we know there's a whole biochemistry and physiology to the exercise component or the stress and the stress reduction component. And then there's the whole part of how do we control inflammation with food, diet, weight, those kinds of things. And what are the foods that are the best in terms of lowering inflammation and improving brain health and optimizing brain function? So putting together those four dimensions is really what Brainweaver is about, but it's also what a lot of the programs we've developed are about. We're very excited. We just are launching this summer a program for brain recovery for veterans who've suffered a mild to moderate traumatic brain injury while in combat, while serving the country. And they come back, they have these symptoms, there's not a lot of care for them. And so we've put together a program, and we're very fortunate to have gotten a grant through the Gary Sinise Foundation Avalon Fund. So there's no cost to the veterans, but they get a comprehensive two-day assessment with us. Dr. Newberg looks at their brain with the most advanced functional neuroimaging. And then the kinds of things we talk about in Brainweaver, we give them a three-week intensive program to get their brain functioning better. So it's just really exciting to see some of the possibilities that are now there.
Well, can you expand on that? Just sure. Focusing on soldiers, veterans, Marines who have had to deal with what, concussion, traumatic brain injury. I'm also thinking of, you know, athletes who've probably had the same experience.
We've had a lot of people from the Eagles and Flyers and of course, kids. You know, we see a lot of younger people who have had injuries in college. And I mean, part of it is to understand what's going on. And that's why, you know, as Dr. Monti was just mentioning, you know, we do a lot of work with brain imaging, because part of the whole key of understanding brain health is the diagnosis and to understand where the abnormalities are. We do MRI imaging. We have a very special scanner called a PET MRI scanner. It's really the only one in the city that is available for adults, actually. And it looks at all the different functions and structures of the brain to help us understand what's going on for any disorder. And picking up on the concussions, for example, one of the things that we have learned is that sometimes when you have a concussion, areas of the brain are overactive. They get overstimulated. They get inflamed. Sometimes they are underactive, meaning that they're just not working that well. And going back to my point about balance, that's a brain that's out of balance. Some areas, you know, when you get emotional, there's parts of the brain that help to control and regulate those emotions. Well, if they're not working properly, well, you become irritable. You become depressed. You become anxious. And when you become anxious and depressed, then you don't think as well. You know, so now you're not functioning as well in your job or at school. And then you become more anxious. And, you know, so it get into these terrible cycles for people that really drives the brain out of balance. And part of our goal is to use many different resources, getting their diet and nutrition back in order. And again, you know, as Dr. Monti mentioned, we're doing the research to show that if you just even start by cleaning up your diet, that has by itself a dramatic impact on helping to fix the brain of somebody who, like a veteran who's had a concussion. But then, helping people to develop those cognitive processes and so forth by different games and different exercises, all of that becomes very important.
And that's Dr. Andrew Newberg, also with us, Dr. Daniel Monti, co-authors of a new book we're talking about. It's called Brainweaver, Creating the Fabric of a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Daniel Monti. He's Chief Executive Officer of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health, founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University. Also with us, Andrew Newberg, professor of integrative medicine and nutritional sciences and research director at the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Thomas Jefferson University, co-author of this book we're talking about called Brainweaver, Creating the Fabric for a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and join us at 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Monti, let me go back to you and actually pick up on something that Andrew Newberg was talking about with the pandemic, and that a part of our brain, we are social creatures, and we have a brain that's kind of designed for social interactions. For a lot of people, it was 12 months of some version of lockdown. Do we know whether the lockdown from the pandemic in any way affected our brains?
We do know that there was an impact on this lockdown on many people. We know that people who were already prone to certain types of issues like depression and anxiety, many people felt worse during that time. And we also know that many people struggled with the isolation. And on top of that, the pandemic was just stressful. So we're talking about different things that stress the brain. Isolation stresses the brain because, as Dr. Newberg said, we're sort of hardwired to be social beings, and the pandemic made that impossible for many people, especially if they lived alone. And so also the pandemic itself triggered a fear response in the brain, because that's normal.
Sure.
When we think about it, we've got these two parts of our autonomic nervous system, sympathetic, which is fight or flight, or parasympathetic, which is restoration and recuperation. The key is to have as much of that restoration and recuperation of the brain turned on as possible, because that's when the body heals itself, and that's when the brain heals itself. When we're too much in that fight or flight mode, it takes a toll on our mental health and our physical health. And I think that a pandemic is the perfect storm for many people being too much in that fight or flight place. If we think about kind of how that nervous system came about, going back in time, you're in the jungle, you see a lion in the distance, you want the nervous system to automatically, that's why we call it the autonomic nervous system, to automatically put you in a certain state to protect yourself.
Right, to run like hell. Yeah,
run like hell. You don't want it to be, do I need to sort of mobilize myself right now? You want to be running up the tree before your brain even has time to process what's going on a conscious level. And that's all good. But the problem is that the lions of yesterday are replaced by things like a pandemic today, where the fight or flight response is ongoing. There's a looming pandemic. Am I going to get sick? Are my older loved ones going to get sick? Homeschooling children, financial insecurity, unclarity about what's going to be happening with job and all kinds of things. So whenever there's a perceived threat to well-being, that fight or flight mechanism goes off, and that's what causes stress. And so chronically this happening, and then not having the tools that people often have in place to cope with stressors, such as social outlets or going to the gym, which wasn't an option for people for many, many months, or whatever it might be, all of those things, traveling, were sort of taken away. And there's increased stress and decreased opportunities to cope with the stress. That's why I called it sort of the perfect storm in the pandemic, for people to have a pretty distressed brain at the end of it all. And we do see the effects of that, which is why when I talk to people now, I tell them, you know, I encourage everyone, okay, breathe your sigh of relief. Mm-hmm. Of course, we all have to be diligent. The pandemic's not over, but there are now more opportunities to do the things that you can do to relax and to recuperate. And also, people, when they got vaccinated, many people felt just immediately more at ease, because there was such a fear about getting the virus or passing the virus on to somebody else. And so now, I think that there's, you know, good opportunities for many people who were very distressed to come out of that fight or flight mode.
I mean, I think euphoria. I certainly felt that once I was vaccinated and was able to reconnect with people in a way that felt safe, and I was protecting myself and protecting them.
Absolutely.
Just, you know, joy, frankly. Let me just ask you, though, and I don't want to spend the rest of the hour on the pandemic,
sure,
but nonetheless, to you, Andrew Newberg, because we are seeing that the impact of the COVID virus on the brain,
right,
on taste and smell, on cognition, on some confusion. What do we know? I mean, who was at risk? What do we need to understand in terms of brain functioning and COVID?
Well, you know, it goes back a little bit to what Dr. Monti was talking about in terms of inflammation, and that's usually what's causing a lot of these different kinds of symptoms. So, you know, there becomes an inflammation in the nerves or in the parts of the brain that are involved in taste or smell, and those are very common aspects of the virus itself. You know, anyone who's had a cold, you know, even just a regular virus knows that when they have a virus, they don't feel well, their head feels heavy, they're not thinking clearly. Again, it's almost not even so much because of the virus itself, but it's our body's reaction to it and all of the what are called interleukins and all these different chemicals that are produced by our immune system to help fight it, which we need. But it does make us feel kind of lousy, and it can affect our brain and it can affect our body. And so, you know, this virus in particular has been, you know, very nasty as far as affecting people in a very strong way. And when it does, it seems to be able to have some impact on the brain's function itself, and we're going to have to really be looking at this long term, you know, to see what the downstream effects are. We don't fully know exactly how this is going to play out in terms of the stressors that Dr. Monti was just talking about. I mean, a year from now, 2 years from now, is everybody going to recover completely? Is there going to be some lingering effects from all of the, you know, all the things that have happened to kids and everyone who's gone through this? And I suspect that there, you know, there will be some lingering elements, but the body and the brain, as we were talking about earlier, is remarkably able to adapt and adjust. And hopefully, if we can help people figure out the ways of doing that through a book like Brainweaver and getting them back into everything, it will at least mitigate as much as possible those negative effects.
We got some calls and some comments here. An email from David: is there any truth to the idea that it's not only the brain making decision? I've heard that there are neurons in the heart and even the intestines that affect behavior. Daniel Monti, let me turn that back to you, and let's talk about the gut, right?
The gut is so important, and I think that what our caller is really getting at is that something that one of my my old mentors once said to me, which is, when you're thinking about things related to the brain, don't stay in the brain. Because we have this neurochemical system where everything is interacting with everything else. So if somebody has a very stressful experience, it's felt throughout the body, because there's all kinds of neurochemicals that are released from that experience. And then there's receptor sites on the cells throughout the body, including the gut, but also including the immune system. Mm-hmm. We know, for example, people who are chronically distressed or stressed have worse immune outcomes regardless of what they're dealing with, whether it's cold and flu, whether it's a different type of illness, because the chemicals that are released have receptor sites on the white blood cells that are part of the immune system. The gut itself, since you mentioned the gut, there is this whole emerging gut-brain axis connection that we do talk about in Brainweaver, and we do think a lot about in our practice, whether we're working with the veterans program or other people who have brain-related issues. We want the gut to be functioning at its best, because if the gut isn't functioning well, there's things that are coming into the system that are going to cause inflammation throughout the body and the brain. And also, certain types of nutrients are important to get processed in the gut, and the function of the gut has to be optimal. And those are nutrients that are then needed in the brain. So that whole axis is very important. In fact, the gut almost has its own nervous system. It's another topic in itself. And it interacts very intricately with this sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system that I'm talking about.
Let me just quickly reintroduce that. Dr. Daniel Monti, also with us, Dr. Andrew Newberg, and they've got a new book. It's called Brainweaver, Creating the Fabric to a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. And we are covering the brain, the body, the whole schmear here on Radio Times. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Andrew Newberg, let me go back to you and talk just a bit about diet, which you write about in the book, having a breakfast every day, something I don't do, eat more vegetables. How should we think about the kind of foods that are good for our brains?
Well, I think part of what we really try to look at, both in the book Brainweaver and even in our Department of Integrative Medicine, is to try to individualize each person's approach, each person's diet, and really help them to get to that healthful diet. So part of what we're talking about, as you just mentioned, are things like making sure that you get a lot of vegetables in your diet. And we, in general,
and we know that's good for the brain.
And we know that's good for the brain. There have been so many studies that have shown that if you're getting your calories and your proteins from plant-based foods instead of meat products and so forth, animal products, that you function better, the brain works better, you have less inflammatory chemicals circulating in your body and in your brain. So we know that that's helpful. We try to get people away from all of the processed foods. Every time you walk into a supermarket and you see everything in cans and boxes, well, not only is there food in there, but there's tons of chemicals and all these other kinds of, preservatives and so forth, which can have an impact on your brain and impact on your body. So the more natural you can be, the more you can get to a plant-based diet, the more protein and healthy proteins you can get in your diet.
Like beans and things
beans,
like that.
Exactly. And the more you can get away from some of the saturated fats which are in mostly a lot of the animal products, all of that has actually been shown to be much more beneficial for the brain. And so, these are part of the things that we kind of, without going into an excessive amount of detail here, but we really try to get people to think about what do they like, or how have they already started to construct their diet. In fact, Dr. Monty and I always lament about, how often in the medical profession, doctors want their patients to lose weight because obesity is such a huge problem in the United States. But basically what they do is they say, eat better. And they don't go into the details. And that's really where it's all about. What are you actually eating for breakfast? And we kind of take people step by step. What are the foods that you are eating currently? And what are the replacements that you can ultimately make to try to get to a more plant-based, more protein-based diet that'll be healthier for your brain? And to be honest, it's healthier for your heart. It's healthier for cancer. It's healthier for a lot of different things as well.
Here's Anne Marie with a question for you, Daniel Monty. Can your guest talk about EMDR?
Sure.
We should define what EMDR stands for.
Sure. EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and it's one of those mind-body techniques that helps people to process traumatic events. It's had some pretty good data behind it. I've looked into it myself and have seen some patients helped by it. It isn't the intervention that we used in the study that Dr. Newberg was referencing. That one was neuroemotional technique. Also, though, getting at the distress in the brain, particularly related to an event that's traumatic in some way. There's lots of ways to approach problems. For us, having as many tools as possible is important to us. Our behavioral health experts that work on our team, such as with the Veterans Brain Health or the Athletes Brain Health programs, or when we're working individually with people, use many of these different interventions and techniques because everybody's different. Some people resonate more with one than another. And that's true whether we're dealing with diet, as Dr. Newberg was saying, not the same exact diet fits everybody, or spiritual health or mental emotional health. I think that one point I wanted to make sure that I underscored in this conversation is that many times when people hear a conversation like this, they feel overwhelmed because they go into all or nothing thinking. Mm-hmm. That if you don't do everything that we're talking about in this conversation or in the book, then there's no point in doing any of it. And that actually isn't true. And what our research has shown is that if you just start somewhere and do something significantly on any of these dimensions, that makes a difference. And then there's a cumulative effect over time. So that, in some of our studies, we just target on one nutrient that we're studying and make sure that person gets that nutrient. Now, again, we want people to do as much as possible and to approach this as holistically and comprehensively as possible. But you don't have to start by just doing everything perfectly. In fact, sometimes people, when they pick up a book like this, they say, well, do I need to start at the beginning, do this, do that? And I'm like, pick the chapter that resonates with you and start there.
Fair enough.
Work on that dimension and then move on to the next one, because it's absolutely the case that there's a fluidity and a plasticity to the brain and the nervous system. The more you do, the better, but doing something makes a difference, and it's much better than doing nothing.
Here's a question back to you, Andrew Newberg, from Bill. What do your guests think of the keto diet as a means of controlling inflammation in the body and brain, since you were talking a little bit about a plant-based diet?
Right. Well, you know, there is a growing body of research that has shown that the keto diet can be beneficial. It seems to be effective in certain specific disorders that some people have been looking at. But, you know, again, to underscore what Dr. Monti was saying, it's certainly not for everyone. And I think, you know, really important, you know, to take a step back is to say that each person needs to even think about this in the context with their doctors to figure out, well, is this kind of a diet going to be okay for me? Is this, you know, are these kinds of approaches going to be okay with for who I am as a person? But yeah, I mean, the keto diet, I mean, it certainly can potentially be beneficial. The diet that we tend to look at usually is a more plant-based, more protein-based diet. So it's certainly a variation on that. But also I wanted to pick up one quick thing.
Sure.
About what Dr. Monti was just saying too, is that, you know, we do stress a lot of times the importance of just kind of focusing on one or two specific things. So for example, if we find out that one of the people who is coming into our office drinks a lot of soda, you know, for example, well, let's just work on that. You know, you don't necessarily have to change everything else about your entire diet. I mean, yes, it's great if somebody really feels that they're going to just revamp everything from scratch. That's terrific.
That's rare.
But, well, you know, oddly enough, we do get a lot of people who are a bit of an all or nothing, you know, and they do want to, but they're in, you know, they're all in and they do that. But a lot of people do struggle with that kind of approach. And so, well, you know, I also try to remind people is that when you expand these things out over a year, you know, if you have a can of soda every day and you multiply that by 365 days, that's thousands and thousands of calories. That's, you know, maybe 20, 30 pounds that you don't, you know, if you just switch that to water, for example, you've made a big dramatic impact on what you're doing. And even when it comes to mind-body practices, people sometimes think, oh, I've got to meditate, you know, an hour a day for it to work. No, the data actually shows that very brief practices – even a couple of minutes just at your desk taking some deep breaths will reduce that sympathetic activity and reduce your stress.
I just took a deep breath because you reminded me to breathe. That's Dr. Andrew Newberg, also with us, Dr. Daniel Monti. And again, we're talking about a book they have co-authored called Brain Weaver. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowing, talking with Thomas Jefferson University physicians Andrew Newberg and Daniel Monti. They join us this hour of Radio Times to share some of the latest in brain science, the best ways to optimize cognitive health. And they've got a new book called Brain Weaver, Creating the Fabric for a Healthy Mind Through Integrative Medicine. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Daniel Monti, let me just read a couple of comments here. One from Rebecca. I'm 13 years divorced. I'm pretty happy in life. But when I think of my ex-husband, I have a PTSD reaction. Could that be helped by the techniques that the authors are talking about?
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly what those techniques were developed for. You know, we did the study in patients who had those same kind of memories related to their cancer diagnosis and cancer treatment experience. But whatever the memory is that has a traumatic component to it, it creates distress in the system. And so as your listener knows, when she has a thought about this person, her body reacts. Right. That's a measurable reaction. When we did this study, we have people hooked up to biofeedback. We see that heart rate changes, the heat given off by the skin changes. So we know that the sympathetic nervous system is activated. When the sympathetic nervous system is activated every time there's a thought of the traumatic reminder, then that's causing ongoing distress in the body. And so I would definitely encourage this person to explore one of the interventions that we're talking about, such as the neuroemotional technique, or as one of the other listeners brought up, EMDR.
EMDR. How about just plain old breathing, Andrew Newberg?
No.
Go ahead, Daniel.
I'm going to jump in on that and
go for it.
Go. Breathing.
Breathing helps for the moment, but with these traumatic memories, and it's important to do it to get past the distress. But the issue is, these sort of traumatic experiences tend to get stuck, so to speak, in the limbic part of the brain. And so even with the passage of time, when there's a reminder cue of that event, whether it's a person, whether it's a cancer diagnosis, whatever it might be, then you go into that sympathetic nervous system activation and then have to breathe. So you can always be dampening it. But the point of these interventions is to disconnect that limbic cognitive or limbic brainstem activation that's going on, so that you don't actually have the distressing response when there's a reminder of it.
Andrew Newberg, is there a quick explanation of neuroemotional technique, NET?
Well, actually, I'm going to throw that back to Dr. Monty because he's a little bit
okay.
more expert on that.
Yeah, just in a minute or less, only because we got a lot to cover and a lot of listeners.
And in the book,
we
have a do-it-yourself version of NET for little events so that people can experience it themselves. But it's a combination of bringing up the emotions, the cognitions, and also the energetic systems of the brain. We use acupressure points and deep breathing, and together getting the network involved with that traumatic experience to talk to itself in a different way.
Here's a question from Marvin. Can the guest comment about the use of infrared light therapy and brainwave biofeedback to increase brain health? I'm going to toss that back to you, Daniel Monti. Yes, no?
That one I was going to toss to...
then I'll toss it to Andrew Newberg.
I'll work on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Part of what we talk about, and even going back to the question that prior guest had asked about the keto diet, we talk about a lot of these different approaches in the book. And again, every approach has the potential to be useful for people, but in the right context. And so, it all has to be part of a larger brain weaver program that, if all you do is breathing, as Dr. Monti was just saying, that's probably not going to be enough to change the way you're thinking about things. If all you do is work on your diet, well, yes, that will help. But if you have other emotional issues or social issues, then those are things that people are going to have to work through. So, for example, with this question, certainly biofeedback and neurofeedback has been shown to be very effective mm-hmm. in the right context. It can be helpful for people. Part of what, people have to understand about themselves is where is the issue? Am I otherwise okay? And it's a very specific issue, like the person was talking about being divorced and thinking about their ex-spouse. Is it something that is more expansive than that they have a lot of anxiety throughout the day? Where are the actual issues that are coming up? Where's the person's strengths and weaknesses? So, biofeedback is about the brain kind of regulating and balancing itself. But if the brain is so out of balance to begin with, then we've got to work on just the biological part first. But then that can be very helpful for helping to bring a person back into that right balance and help them with whatever psychological or neurological issues that they're dealing with.
Daniel Monti, let me go back to you and ask you more about exercise and activity. I mean, it's great to take a walk, I'm assuming, but the idea of really getting that sweat up, getting the heart rate up and its impact on the brain. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, exactly that, the heart rate up. And so people need to find whatever form of exercise works for them because we want blood flow to the brain. Right. And when we're too sedentary, then it's at an all-time low when we're sedentary. And when we're moving about, that blood flow increases. And that's a very important thing for the tone of the brain and the tone of the body. And we found through research that actually exercise, in terms of protecting against some of the age-related changes that occur with how the brain functions, is one of the most protective things to do, physical exercise.
And just be, for all the reasons that you just described, you get your heart rate up, you get the brain, you get the blood in the brain, all of that.
And you're decreasing inflammation in the system.
Right.
Many years ago, Andrew Newberg, you were a guest on Radio Times. You were actually at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, talking about your research into religion and spirituality. I mean, I think it's expanded beyond that, but
yes,
its impact on the brain. Help us understand where the research stands now when it comes to brain health and a belief in something outside of oneself.
Sure. Well, and the research continues to this day, and we've done a lot of great work at Jefferson on that. Well, you know, the spiritual side of ourselves is an important dimension for really all of us. Now, for some of us, that is a more specifically religious perspective. And when people are dealing with various stressors like a pandemic and so forth, you know, being able to turn to something that's spiritual or even religious can be very helpful for them. It can help them cope. A lot of research has shown that when people are dealing with life stressors, having that religious side can be very effective for them. And various practices that people do, prayer, meditation, and so forth. Again, you know, we have done all of this brain imaging studies, a lot of them here at Jefferson, where we are showing exactly what's going on in the brain and how these practices help to settle down, for example, that sympathetic nervous system that Dr. Monti has been talking about, but also how it actually augments other parts of our brain. So, you know, an area that we haven't talked about a lot yet is the frontal lobe. So our frontal lobe helps to regulate a lot of our brain's functions. It helps to regulate and sort of control our emotional responses. So, you know, when somebody cuts you off in the freeway, it's the sympathetic nervous system that says, oh, I got to kill that guy. And then it's the frontal lobe say, hey, you know, we got work to do. Let's forget about it. Let's move on. But so, you know, one of the ways of getting that frontal lobe to work is through practices like meditation, prayer, where you're kind of concentrating on something, you're reflecting on something. And that actually seems to be very, very beneficial. And we've even done a study several years ago at Jefferson where we sent people to a spiritual retreat program. And not only did we look at the areas of the brain that are turned on or turned off, but we looked at the neurotransmitters, dopamine and serotonin, which were actually significantly affected by just spending a week in kind of contemplation and kind of reflecting on who you are. And it made the brain more sensitive to the effects of serotonin and dopamine. And those are the neurotransmitters that are involved in our sense of well-being, our sense of, you know, whether we're depressed or not. So it really ties all together. It's another part of who we are. And of course, for people who are not religious, there are so many ways of experiencing that spiritual side. And it can be through creative outlets, music, art, being in nature, even just doing, you know, humanistic things, going out and doing charitable work, being altruistic and helping other people. You know, all these different ways of kind of connecting to the rest of humanity, connecting to our world. These are the ways in which people can really derive a lot of benefit from.
And it's measurable.
I mean,
that's what's so interesting. And just to quote from the book, it appears that religion maps well onto these processes by giving us an understanding of ourselves, regulating our body's functions through various practices like meditation and prayer, providing us with a sense of ontological wisdom, which does, you know, even if you're not religious, but you're a deep thinker. I mean, does it have the same kind of effect?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of what religion specifically brings to people, and part of what we're also talking about in the context of the larger sense of spirituality for people, is that sense of connection, is that sense of having faith and optimism in a better world. And, you know, when we look at what's going on around us in the political landscape and, you know, the environment and all these things that make us so, you know, the pandemic, that make us so stressed out, having a sense that there is something ahead of us, there's something that will be okay, is extraordinarily powerful for the human brain. In fact, a big research study that came out a few years ago showed that people who just had the highest levels of optimism had markedly reduced amounts of heart disease and cancer and brain problems. So, you know, just having that sense of faith, whether it is a, you know, true religious faith or it is just a sense of the world's going to be okay and maybe we can just find our ways of making the world a little bit better, That really is very powerful for us and keeps our brain healthy.
Is it a chicken egg thing, or we really know that having that sense of optimism has all those benefits for the brain?
Well, you know,
it becomes a circular thing. Right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, part of what we talk about in Brainweaver is that, you know, you can do certain things that can help you to continue to focus on the positive. We know that, you know, there's a cute phrase that neurons that fire together wire together, and so if you think about the positive side of the world, if you think about optimism, if you try, you know, have feelings of gratitude and compassion, and you focus on that through practices like meditation or prayer, for example, then those are the neural connections that continue to strengthen and form, so that now when you go out into the world, you will be more compassionate, you will be more loving, you will be more forgiving. If, on the other hand, you sit there and you just listen to the news and worry about everything and stew about how horrible everybody is and get angry and scared and anxious, well, those are the neural connections that continue to form. And it goes back to what we've been talking about with things like the neuroemotional technique, is to change that way of processing through the different things that are going on in your world, and to try to bring you into that more positive set point. So, you know, certainly we all have our baseline. You know, some people are a little bit more optimistic than others. But, you know, as I said, obviously, like, I'm a tennis player. And, you know, if everybody in the world played tennis 6 hours a day, we'd all be really good. But there's only going to be a few Djokovic's and Federer's out there. So, you know, there's always a range. But we can all get better at what we do, and we can all balance our brain better.
Daniel Monte, I'm sure you have things to say, but let me just read a couple of comments. Lori wonders whether what we've been talking about would help with Tourette syndrome. Is that something that you've looked at?
We haven't specifically looked at Tourette syndrome. And Tourette syndrome is a neurological disorder which, you know, almost always requires medication. However, any illness, if we apply some of the principles that we're talking about, the road is very often better. If you have a calmer nervous system, we know that neurological disorders have fewer flare-ups. Psychiatric disorders have fewer flare-ups. And so we still advocate the same balanced brain health approach, whether the person has Parkinson's disease or Tourette syndrome. And in fact, I mentioned Parkinson's disease because there are specific neurological disorders such as Parkinson's disease and MS where we have done this kind of research, where we've looked at specific nutrients, specific brain health activities to see if it gives people an edge in what's, you know, overall a very debilitating illness. And sure enough, it always shows that it does.
We're almost out of time here. And Daniel Monte, I wanted to go back to you. You talked about stress. And I know for certain neighborhoods, there are children going up in these neighborhoods where they are dealing with what is called toxic stress, whether it's stress within the home, stress in the neighborhood, hearing gunshots at night, knowing people who have been, you know, murdered or shot. And I worry about these youngsters growing up under that environment and what we know about their brains, what we can do to help them.
It's a huge problem. It's a significant problem for all of us to be thinking about and addressing, because we really need more resources in those neighborhoods to have programs for these children. And to add to what you said, these are the neighborhoods that are very often food deserts.
Right.
So they're not feeding the nervous system, and they're constantly distressing the nervous system because that's the environment. And it's something that many of us are thinking about when we get involved with philanthropic programs and nonprofit organizations. It's something that we think about when we come up with, gee, what type of clinical trial or program can we be doing that we can get funding for? Because what you're talking about is a huge, huge problem.
Well, we have to leave it there. But my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Daniel Monte, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. He is CEO of the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health and founding chair of the Department of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences at Thomas Jefferson University. Andrew Newberg, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he is professor of Integrative Medicine and Nutritional Sciences and research director at the Marcus Institute of Integrative Health at Thomas Jefferson University. And again, co-authors of this new book we've been talking about called Brainweaver. Creating the fabric for a healthy mind through integrative medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.